Hello everybody and welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. Big show planned for you, including two different candidates, one for Congress, one for the Senate. It's gonna be joining us over the course of the next hour. We'll also be closing out the hour with the return of Meanwhile In, a news from the UK. We're gonna do a little bit of a dive into the accuracy of ads being run in this election, which is, by the way, ongoing right now. I'm assuming by the time you would see this, if you're not watching it live, it's probably too late to vote. But if there is still time, you should go do that because it seems pretty important in this case. And let's see, we've got what are Trump supporters gonna do if he gets impeached? There's some amazing video that was run on CBS News. We're gonna be talking about that. Pete Buttigieg asked about his low polling numbers for youth voters and he responds. I think we can learn something from his response. We'll have that for you. And there's other news too. I just wanna briefly start off with what I was talking about right before the show began. And that is the massive news that on the same day in May, John Wick 4 and The Matrix 4 coming out on the same day. That's crazy. Is that not crazy? Those are massive movies, both starring the same guy. And you'd think, as much as I am looking forward to the double feature there, would they really want those movies to compete with each other? That seems like an interesting strategy. I don't know, but anyway, the reason I bring that up in the beginning is I'm gonna be really distracted as I go through these stories. That's basically why I'm gonna be thinking about that. And also trying to answer the question in my mind, who would win in a fight, Neo or John Wick? Does it take place in the Matrix? These are the conversations I wanna have. But there's others we should probably have, including about the National Defense Authorization Act. So let's turn to that. Today, another big win for Donald Trump with the House passing the NDAA. That's the National Defense Authorization Act for 2020. It passed in a 377-48 vote. In all, 41 Democrats and 6 Republicans voted against it. That's the sort of vote, by the way, that you don't often see on anything not purely symbolic, the naming of a post office or something, and rarely even on something like that lately. So we're gonna return to some of those no's because I think they're important. We're also gonna have some video from one of the prominent no voters. But first, Donald Trump very happy to have his NDAA passing. He says, wow, all of our priorities have made it into the final NDAA. Pay raise for our troops, rebuilding our military, that's a very specific priority. God knows what that means. Paid parental leave, border security, and Space Force. Congress, don't delay this anymore. I will sign this historic defense legislation immediately. But will he? Because the House passed it, controlled by Democrats. They're gonna have to square the circle with the versions and all that with the Senate. Will Mitch McConnell actually be up to that? I mean, his strategy recently seems to have been, until this impeachment thing is wrapped up, he's not gonna do anything because he believes it will hurt the Democrats. In this case, Trump is desperate to sign this thing, so it'll be interesting to see if that strategy continues. But while this is a big win for Donald Trump, not necessarily a big win for people who care about human rights, civilian deaths, and all of that, as well as massive waste in the spending for our military. So let's talk about some of what ended up in this final version. The final bill dropped a slew of other Democratic priorities that were in the House bill originally, including language to reverse Trump's transgender military ban, block Trump from taking military action against Iran, end all US support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen, force the cleanup of cancer-linked chemicals that we've talked about several times on the show, block the deployment of the low-yield nuclear warhead, and ban new transfers to the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. And that paragraph is the sort of paragraph that reminds us that you can quickly put words in an order and it sort of glosses over how significant those are. Almost any one of those things is worthy of an incredible amount of attention. Trying to reverse Trump's transgender ban, that should be a slam dunk. How do you not press for that to be in the final version? Stopping the deployment of the low-yield nuclear warhead. This brings us one step closer to casual use of nuclear arms in regular conflicts. That's in the middle of the paragraph. That's just one of the things. We could have just cut that out. That seems significant. So all of these priorities, the House, dominated by the Democrats, they couldn't get this stuff in there. But what they did get was $120 billion extra dollars for the military. That amount, which for the vast majority of the countries around the world would be an expansive military budget all its own, that's just the increase they're getting. Already a huge amount. And I wanna give credit to Ro Khanna because he's been a leader in this issue for a long time. He spoke on the House floor about this. You should definitely go find his full address, but we have a few of the highlights right here.
I rise in strong opposition to this defense authorization. There are many things that you can call the bill, but it's Orwellian to call it progressive. Let's speak in facts. When President Obama left, the defense budget was $618 billion. This defense budget is $120 billion more than what President Obama left us with. That could fund free public college for every American. It could fund access to high-speed, affordable internet for every American. But it's worse. The bipartisan provision to stop the war in Yemen, stripped by the White House. The bipartisan amendment to stop the war in Iran, stripped by the White House. The bipartisan provision to repeal the 2002, the George W. Bush authorization for the war in Iraq, which is sending our troops overseas, stripped by the White House. At some time, we can't just rhetorically give standing ovations when the president says we're going to end endless wars and continue to vote to fund them.
He is 100% right and consistently right on these issues. $120 billion more. Because, you know, I think a lot of objective observers in the final year of the Obama administration were thinking, our military is not big enough. We only spend more than virtually every other country on earth combined on our military. Who thinks that the way we should allocate funds is that first, before everything else, let's not talk about healthcare, let's not talk about education, anything like that. Just for the military, if we can't simultaneously defeat the militaries of all other countries combined, then we're not safe. And even that, is that really enough? Is there any limit where we will boost it another 100 billion, 200 billion, and Republicans will think, okay, we've probably gone too far? No, because the money is going to go to private military contractors, it's going to go to buying more tanks, more bombs. They're going to find excuses to use it. And they've certainly got great options in here, because taking away the authorization for the war in Iraq means that at any time, Donald Trump, who swears he doesn't want to be there, could jack up troop levels again. In Syria, God only knows how much of this money is going to be turned into bombs and dropped over Syria. We're going to continue to be working with Saudi Arabia to make sure that every single civilian in Yemen has to fear death on a daily basis. All of that in a bill that is being pitched as progressive. What's progressive about it? I echo Ro Khanna's words there. One good win, the inclusion of a policy that would grant all federal workers 12 weeks of paid parental leave in what's being touted as a historic deal to give the benefit to more than 2 million Americans for the first time ever. That's good. And at what cost? We have the majority in the House. That's supposed to be worth something. He can't get this bill without the Democrats signing on to it. And so we should, with that power, the ability to grind this to a halt, we should be asking for so much more. The parental leave, that's great. I would argue like advancing it for a couple of million Americans that's small potatoes. Literally every American should have access to that. But we should be getting so much more, and not just the stuff that I listed in that paragraph. Why are we involved in these disastrous conflicts? Use Donald Trump's words against him. He says he's against these forever wars. He says that Barack Obama and past politicians, they were stupid and wasteful in being involved in these conflicts. And yet he continues our involvement in them. And now we'll have even more money to pursue those military adventures. This is moronic. This is one of the worst moves I've seen from House Democrats over the past year. Not all of them, of course. Ro Khanna voted against it. Members of the squad and other members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Tulsi Gabbard. There were 41 Democrats who voted against it and 6 Republicans who have at least some measure of principles in this area. But this is insanity. When I talk about cutting the military budget in half, and people like gasp and say, well, how could we possibly defend ourselves? We were doing just fine a couple of years ago when it was $120 billion less. Now in the future, under a future progressive president, we're gonna have to fight against the same sort of response just to get it back down to $600 to $700 billion. That's how insane this is. And by the way, turn on CNN right now, turn on MSNBC. Are they gonna stack panels saying, how are we gonna pay for this $120 billion? What is this actually buying? I guarantee it's not. Best case scenario, it's gonna be finally some bipartisanship in DC. That's amazing. Well, this is the sort of bipartisanship you can always count on. Raising the military budget, that's the easiest thing to do in government, even if it doesn't actually reflect our values in any way, and certainly not progressive values. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. A candidate's gonna join us on the other side.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Republican Senator in Texas John Cornyn finds himself facing a crowd of Democrats that would love to run against him in his Senate reelection bid next year. And one of those candidates joins us now, Christina Sinsun Ramirez. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you on. Not a big fan of John Cornyn, so excited to see him facing so much opposition. But sort of as I alluded to in the intro, this is a pretty packed field. You have a lot of candidates in the Democratic primary. You have some independents as well, other Republicans running. So entering into that sort of race is different than some other primary races where it's one or two, you know, candidates duking it out. What's it been like so far in you know, trying to differentiate yourself, trying to get media coverage, all that when there are so many in the field?
Well, I think what's important to know about Texas is that our state is rapidly changing. And so there's a real opportunity to unseat John Cornyn. He actually has lower favorability ratings in Texas than Ted Cruz, which is pretty hard for a lot of people to believe that someone can be more disliked than Ted Cruz, but he is in our state. So it's a crowded field of 10 people running. I don't believe competitive primaries are anything to be afraid of. I think that's part of democracy and a good thing. Of the major candidates, there's 10 people running, but really only three, maybe four, that are real candidates that have staff, have raised money, have progressive organizations behind them. And I am the only candidate of the major candidates that's an actual progressive. So I'm the only candidate that supports Medicare for all. I'm the only candidate that supports the Green New Deal. And I also importantly reflect the diversity of our state. So our state is majority people of color. In Texas, one in three of us are immigrants or children of immigrants. My mom is the oldest of nine kids from Mexico, and I'm the only candidate that's fully bilingual. And then also importantly, I'm the only candidate that's been an organizer. So I've spent a decade and a half in our state leading some of our largest voting and civil rights organizations, bringing people together to raise wages for workers, makes jobs safer in Texas, and take on issues like student debt and climate change. So I'm running as an unapologetic progressive, proud to be a progressive and proud to represent the diversity of Texas and the future of who I think Texas is. And I think John Cornyn and the Republican Party represent the past in our state.
So here at the Damage Report, especially for as important a race as this is, I mean, taking over the Senate is not just important for Texas, but also for a future Democratic president. We want to make sure that people have information about all the candidates, so we've been trying to bring on multiple. But I want to give you more time to talk about your platform, because it's Texas. Still, people consider it a red state. It has, I mean, that last race between Cruz and O'Rourke was very close. And so you say Medicare for all, Green New Deal. Are you worried that in any parts of the state, running as an unabashed progressive could potentially hurt you?
Well, you know, I've done political work in Texas for over 15 years. I know that there is no lefty choir to preach to, that there are only a bunch of non-believers to convert. And so the way I talk about my progressive politics, whether I'm talking about Medicare for all or the Green New Deal, is about how it makes the most basic common sense for Texans. So when I talk about Medicare for all, I talk about the fact that in Texas, we have the highest uninsured rate in the country. 1 in 6 Texans don't have health insurance, and that the best quality system would be Medicare for all, that by allowing private health insurance companies to profit off of our pain, suffering, and illness, we've not only created the most expensive healthcare system in the world, we've created one with some of the worst outcomes of any industrialized nation, and that by any measure, that's a failed system. And even on the Green New Deal, people think about Texas being synonymous with oil and gas, but Texas is changing. And so we are actually now the largest wind producer in the country. We have 250,000 people that work in the oil and gas industry and 233,000 that worked in advanced energy, being green energy. And that will soon outpace the oil and gas sector. So to me, why the Green New Deal is so important to Texas is because, one, we have suffered firsthand the real catastrophic consequences of not taking action on climate change, what you see in the last few hurricanes here in Texas. And also because the new Green Deal says we're not going to leave any workers behind as we transition our economy. Well, I think that's really important for Texas because we have 250,000 workers that work in that industry.
So as of right now, the Democratic Party, I mean, I know they're not supposed to get too involved during the primary. That has not stopped them before. Have they been weighing in on the field at all?
Yeah, so I was asked to run not by anyone in Washington. No one asked me at the Democratic Senate Committee. I was asked to run by our state's largest progressive leaders, and also people that help run Beto O'Rourke's Senate campaign asked me to run. And there are people in this race. One of my opponents, MJ Hager, who was recruited and asked to run by the Democratic Senate Committee. They have not endorsed in this race, but I am proud that I'm being run as a real Texas candidate by the real Texas organizations and institutions that have been on the ground doing progressive work in our state for over a decade and a half.
So I only mention this because you say that some of the people who'd been involved with his campaign had asked you to move into this. One of the criticisms of Beto O'Rourke's campaign, both right before the loss and in the sort of postmortem, was that he had early on been running as a strong progressive, but it seemed like the closer he got to that general election, the more he backed off in terms of his support for Medicare for All. His performance in the debates seemed designed to play down the progressive policies he'd been championing earlier. There were still a few sort of like social issues he was pushing, but some of those core issues he definitely backed off of. I don't know if that's just the pressure you face when you're running for Senate or if it was consultants, but I am curious what you think about the possibility that you could face pressure like that were you to be chosen as the candidate.
I've faced pressure over my political work and career. I've learned that when they asked me to run, I've never run for political office before, and I've been asked to run, but I always made the decision not to run because I always wanted to speak my truth. So when I was asked to run, I let people know that I was going to run, but I wanted to win on the merit of my ideas, that I believe that's what democracy is all about. And so if you ask me where I stand on any issue, you will always get a straight answer. And I believe that we don't give voters enough credit that they can smell when someone's disingenuous, when someone's feeding them BS. And with me, I really, really want to win on the merit of my ideas. And I think that there's a long tradition in Texas of economic populism that people are unaware of that has long been a part of our state's history and the political context of our state historically.
Well, I certainly agree with you there. Where can people go if they'd like to find out more about your candidacy and your platform?
They can go to christinafortexas.com. And they can also find us, of course, on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. What I would say also is really important about this race, it's not just about the Senate race. It's about the fact that Texas could go blue in 2020 and that we need to make sure that we have a real progressive that helps do that so that we can make sure that Texas, the second largest economy, the second most populous state in the country, has a long-term progressive vision that will help reshape the rest of the country, because it isn't just about one election cycle. When Republicans lose Texas in 2020, it will change the political outcome of our country for a generation.
Once again, I cannot disagree with you there. Christina, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks.
Want to take a short break here. When we come back, CBS News airs footage with Trump supporters talking about what they will do if Trump is removed from office. Scary stuff. Stick around.
Put your body in paralysis.
Well, many rational people watching this impeachment process are sort of mentally preparing for the Senate trial portion of it. Some of his supporters are preparing for what comes after, and they're getting ready for war. Take a look at this bit of video that CBS News posted of them interviewing some Trump fans.
He's not going to be removed.
You feel confident in that?
My 357 Magnum is comfortable with that. End of story.
And they remove him in the Senate?
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd cause physical violence in this country that we haven't seen since the first Civil War. I think it would become the second Civil War.
I would think that there would be a strong movement. It would be very negative. Possible violence. Not that I'm condoning violence. There'll be a lot of mad Americans, possibly 70, 80 million Americans on the loose, not very happy.
Yeah, I'm not condoning violence. I'm just bringing it up on my own without being asked specifically about it constantly at the very thought that at some point Trump might not be president again. And weirdly, a whole bunch of the people that love going to these rallies and wearing red hats, when asked, what do you think about him eventually leaving office? Their thoughts are, I'm going to grab my gun and start shooting, as Edwin was asking while that video was playing, who exactly? Who are you going to shoot with your 357 Magnum? Are you going to shoot Adam Schiff? Is the people who are doing the impeachment? Are you going to shoot other Democratic politicians? Or are you just going to start shooting random liberals? Is that the idea that there's a civil war? Because after all, that's not just a few politicians versus the masses. That's two big sides. So I'm a liberal. You're going to shoot me? I think Trump has committed impeachable offenses. I think he should be removed from office. Are you going to shoot me if he's removed from office? Is that the idea? These tough guys in red hats, that guy, yeah, he's going to pull out his pistol and he's going to fight in the second Civil War. That's what's going to happen. The guy who would die if he tried to do 20 push-ups right there, he's going to start taking on the masses because Donald Trump is removed for trying to bribe Ukraine into interfering in the 2020 election. I love these fake macho conservatives. That guy would be hiding at the sound of a first shot. All of them would. They go to these rallies because what they need is they want to be able to say racist, xenophobic things, but they want to feel comfortable doing it. That's why they go to a big rally and they surround themselves with tens of thousands of other people who believe the exact same thing. And if a single person even shouts out something they don't like, they want them hauled out of the room. They want the police to beat them on the way out. Yeah, real tough people, okay, when they're surrounded by people who don't disagree with them on a single thing. But honestly, this is something we return to every once in a while because this idea that if I don't get my way, I'm gonna start killing people, that is the go-to for conservatives now. You saw it when Beto O'Rourke talked about some sort of mandatory gun buyback if assault weapons were outlawed. And Ben Shapiro's response to that was, I will kill the person who comes to my house if he tries to do that. There was a thing about like, I think it was Ben Shapiro too, where he was like, if they try to teach my kids that gay marriage is okay, I will kill the person who tries to do that. This is their go-to. For all that they love to talk about how they have the ideas, they have the logic on their side, they're reasonable people. If something doesn't go their way, indeed, if anything doesn't go their way, they believe that they should be able to start shooting people. And some of them threaten it, like the guy with the pistol. Some of them, like another guy in that video, like Meghan McCain, they just say, oh, I think there will be violence. I think people will be shooting if you try to take their guns away. They don't actually ever imply that that would be a terrible thing, that that would be a horrible, immoral thing. They're just observers. And you know what? Yeah, there might be a war if Donald Trump is impeached. And the issue too is that Donald Trump has, of course, encouraged this. Other Republicans have encouraged this. So let's turn now to Louis Gohmert.
To be a one-sided, non-due process sham court. And it's about to push this country to a civil war if they were to get their wishes. And if there's one thing I don't want to see in my lifetime, I don't want to ever have participation in, it's a civil war.
Okay, but it didn't stop you from bringing it up in your address. You're not responding to a question. Nobody asked you. You're worried about a civil war. You just decided, I think it'll be a civil war. I mean, I don't want that. I don't want to participate in that. And let's talk about intellectual consistency. So all of these people, regular conservative voters, Louis Gohmert, Trump himself, which we'll get to in just a second. When the Republicans were impeaching Bill Clinton, were they worried about a civil war? Were they saying, you know, I hate that this will probably leave our country racked with civil war, with conflict, but we just have to impeach him because we're worried he got a blowjob. Is that what was going on? Or is it just a threat to stop any sort of consequences whatsoever from Donald Trump for his actions? Is that a constant thing? Is that ideological consistency that they think that impeachment is never warranted because it's an overthrow of an election and because it could lead to civil war? Or is it a convenient thing that they deploy when the president they support is facing consequences for the first time in his actual life? And as I alluded to, Trump has also encouraged this. We'll get to that in one sec. This is just like a casual thing now that everyone throws around, whether you're a politician like Louis Gohmert, whether you're a pundit like Ben Shapiro, whether you're an MLB umpire like Rob Drake, who tweeted about the ongoing House impeachment inquiry saying, I will be buying an AR-15 tomorrow because if you impeach my president this way, you will have another civil war, MAGA 2020. He had to later apologize for that. Because some people thought that it was inappropriate for him to be threatening to gun people down with an assault weapon if impeachment went through. Trump himself has not been, you know, sort of totally hands off here. He tweeted what Pastor Robert Jeffress said, if the Democrats are successful in removing the president from office, which they will never be, it will cause a civil war-like fracture in this nation from which our country will never heal. Which is not just threatening, obviously. All of this is just, we will not follow the Constitution. Forget that whole thing about impeachment, because if you do that, we will start killing you. The idea that in 20 years, in 50 years, in 150 years, like with our first civil war, people will be looking back and saying, how dare they take out Donald Trump back then? That was when our country truly started to go downhill. If the best case scenario for Republicans at this point is that in 20 or 30 years, people pretend like Trump was never president. You are not going to be wanting us to be looking back critically on what he did and what the Republican Party was okay with. But anyway, the issue isn't just the regular Trump supporters. It's not just the politicians that are goading them into violence. It's also the people who organize exclusively around their desire to start killing people in support of American fascism. Like the Oath Keepers who tweeted, here's the money quote from that thread. This is the truth. This is where we are. We are on the verge of a hot civil war like in 1859. That's where we are. And the right has zero trust or respect for anything the left is doing. We see them as illegitimate too. That was just a couple of months ago. That group is desperate to start killing people. And again, I don't know who. Politicians, civilians. What, the military and the cops? Are you gonna start gunning down cops? Is that what you're threatening to do? They're all really vague, but it doesn't matter who. All of that horrible, horrible stuff that they feel totally comfortable saying. And then they get people on programs like The View with Meghan McCain just, you know, maybe we gotta start shooting people. It's totally acceptable in 2019 to start threatening that if things don't go your way politically, you're gonna start killing people. And by the way, right now it's about impeachment, but you don't think that as we get closer to the general election, they're gonna be saying the same things? Like, oh no, those fake voters in California, if it doesn't go our way, we're gonna grab our guns. They were saying that in 2016, and now they love Trump even more. So anticipate that. No, this is serious. Something needs to be done to prepare for the possibility that more acts of domestic terrorism are gonna come if Trump is impeached, if God help us if he's removed, it's probably not gonna happen, but if it does, and as we get closer to the election, these people are deranged and they identify solely as gun owners. That's all they are, and they are desperate to start using those guns on humans. Okay, we had something else I wanted to get to in this block, but unfortunately we didn't. We're gonna take a short break. We come back, Joshua Collins is gonna be joining the Damage Report once again after this. J. Joining us once again, congressional candidate for Washington's 10th district, Joshua Collins. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, John.
Glad to have you here. I'm excited to learn, you know, what's been going on in the race. I know that there's been some development in the field. So catch us up a little bit. It's been a while since we last spoke. How is the race going?
It's going really well. My opponent, Denny Heck, he dropped out.
That's a big development.
He decided. Yeah, he announced his retirement. And in the 48 hours after that, we raised $25,000 over thousands of donors.
Mm-hmm. And so yeah. I'm curious, right now, if I'm not mistaken, you're running unopposed.
Basically, yeah. There is no one on the left, and we're a very blue district. So at the moment, no establishment Democrat has thrown in yet.
Okay, well, you seem pretty casual considering that. That seems like a pretty big development. But I know that obviously the work of campaigning continues. I think the last time we spoke, you identified as a socialist trucker. And obviously in this sort of race, you gotta drive around, you gotta talk to people. You're very experienced in that. So talk to me about the campaign process, getting to know the voters and all of that. How is that proceeding?
It's going well. You know, we are already working on canvassing and getting connected to the community, and we're really using social media effectively. You know, I've been kind of all over the place. It's just meeting after meeting. You know, this is like kind of what you want when you're running a race where you're just so busy that, like, you know, you don't really have time to waste. So we decided to scale up early, and we were expecting Heck to drop out when he did. And I don't want to go into that too much, but you know, we were prepared for that. So.
Okay. Well, you happen to join us on the day that the NDAA has passed. A lot more money going to the military, attempts to withdraw our support from the war in Yemen were stripped out of it. A number of other progressive efforts were removed from the final bill. You have a very bold foreign policy platform. So for those who might not be familiar with it, if you were in charge, what are some of the changes you would make to the way we fund our military, the sorts of adventures we engage in abroad, all of that?
Well, I would end the vast majority of what we have going on abroad. I would also abolish the CIA and just put an end to the intervention that our country's been doing in order to secure natural resources of other nations.
Okay, and so I'd seen previously that you had called for the elimination of, I believe it was DHS, the NSA, correct? Do you believe that there's any role for some sort of organized intelligence gathering department in the government?
Yeah, sure, but it can be done under the military.
Okay, and so tell me about other aspects of your platform in terms of the environment, perhaps. What are you pushing for if you make it into Congress?
Just broad sweeping reforms and restructuring of our economy. You know, we need to. If we actually want to deal with climate change on the level that's necessary, it's going to require restructuring our entire economy and just completely transitioning to the Green New Deal as soon as possible. And if we want the rest of the world to follow, we need to do it now and do it as quickly as possible.
So let's talk about a development in the area of the environment in your area. So Governor Jay Inslee, tell me about this liquefied natural gas plant. I know you've been tweeting about it. He, during his candidacy for the presidency, was really strong when it comes to the environment. But tell me about this particular issue. Is his reputation holding up in this area?
No. You know, we have people calling his office today, you know, just demanding for him to declare a climate emergency and also take, you know, the handling of this and put it under a different agency. Because the agency that's been handling it is clearly not taking it seriously. And they're also using very old data from like 2006 and old science that is from, you know, the early 2000s as well. So what we are trying to do is to get him to take this seriously and just put a stop to the LNG plant. You know, it was just given its final permit. And although it will be challenged in the courts, if it actually does get completed and is allowed to go operational. You know, it is on the ancestral waters of the Medicine Creek Treaty tribes, the Puyallup tribe. and it has a pipeline that goes right under reservation land. Oh, wow. This is essentially the Northwest's, no DAPL. We are trying to stop this LNG plant and the pipeline from being operational as well.
And do you have any sort of read for how likely it is that it could be stopped at this point?
It all depends on how much help we get and how much pressure we put. The Puyallup tribe is, challenging in the courts, and we just need to get as much pressure on Jay Inslee to act and others, and have a special session in the legislature in Washington for climate in particular. And what we really need in Washington is we need it to be treated the way the Dakota Access Pipeline was. We need the attention of the entire nation on this. We need presidential candidates to start speaking out against it. And we need, congressional candidates and anyone who is at all claiming that they, care about the environment or that they stand with Native Americans, then we need them to speak out on this and, help us, put pressure on Inslee to just shut it down.
And it seems like considering the reputation that he has and certainly that he wants to have, that this is an area where pressure could potentially be successful. So hopefully people will join you in that. Joshua Collins, as always, we appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you.
All right, thanks, bye.
Bye. We're gonna take a short break. When we come back, news from around the world. And meanwhile, in. And now it's time for news from around the world. And meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in the UK, it is election day. So really quick, if you're in the UK, go vote, assuming there's still time. It's really, really important, whether it's, you're voting based on the NHS or the future of Brexit. You like Corbyn, you don't like Johnson. I don't know, go vote, okay? It's really important. And us here in the US, we could use some good political news. But inside of that election, there is an issue, and that is that there is some lying going on. Some 88% of the most widely circulated Tory ads during the first 4 days of December included inaccurate claims, according to disinformation tracking organization First Draft. So that is ads being run generally in social media by the Conservative Party. Almost all of them contain misinformation. This thankfully is something that people have been talking a lot so far this year. The willingness of social media outlets to allow outright lies, known lies, to continue to be spread for pay. We're seeing that not just in the US, but it's affecting the UK as well. And it's about really important stuff. The ads included false claims about the NHS and income tax, as well as the Labour Party and its plans, so basically everything. The Coalition for Reform in Political Advertising called on politicians to be legally required to be accurate in their ads, a proposal supported by 87% of the British public. And so, this is not what people actually want. And the idea that people decide, let the politicians say whatever they want and then people will go and they'll figure out what's actually true. For people who are busy, who barely have time to pay attention to politics in the first place, we need some sort of assurance that if you're being paid to spread a message, that we can have opinion, we can have exaggeration, I get that. But if you know that something's a lie, leaving it in there, that is a complete abdication of any responsibility you have as a platform for the spread of information. Now let's look at some of the ways that this has worked out. First Draft's analysis looked at almost 7,000 ads that the Tories posted to Facebook in early December. Most of them, over 5,000, pushed a claim about the Conservatives building, quote, 40 new hospitals. That claim has been comprehensively debunked by a wide range of independent fact-checking organizations who have pointed out that the party has in fact promised to build 6 hospitals, not 40, kind of important. The ads included false claims about funding the NHS as well, and about Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party's spending plans. This is an election that is very important, and unfortunately the damage is already done in terms of these fake ads. Hopefully they didn't affect too many people, hopefully people got correct information from other sources, but the fear is that that is out there. And this is an election that has been getting tighter and tighter as we've gotten closer to election day. We're gonna have to see what happens. Tomorrow we're gonna have a journalist from the UK is going to Skype in to talk about the results. But again, if you're there, go vote. Meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in Indonesia, I know this is gonna be really weird, we don't normally talk about this, but they found what is now believed to be the oldest cave art ever. It's not super important news, but hey, it's pretty cool. Let's take a look at this picture. You're seeing there, That was art that was scrawled on a cave wall 44,000 years ago, before the universe was created. No, I'm kidding, but that's pretty amazing. And we know a little bit about this, and we can learn something about the people who made that art from what they included there. The painting shows a group of figures that represent half animal, half human hybrids called therianthropes. The therianthropes are hunting warty pigs and dwarf buffaloes called anoas using spears and ropes. That's kind of cool. Honestly, if this was a full story, I'd probably read it. But imagine that long ago, like just somebody is in this cave and scrawling this story that they came up with. It's not a real thing that they saw, but they're using creativity and storytelling. That's pretty amazing. And so we have a couple of quotes from a study author, the people who looked into this initially discovered it. The most fascinating aspect of our research is that humanity's oldest cave art is at least 44,000 years old, and it already has all of the key components related to modern cognition, like hand stencils, figurative art, storytelling, therianthropes, which are popping up in more and more youth urban fantasy these days, and religious thinking. And what's even more amazing is this was discovered. You might think, well, haven't we already looked in all these caves? No, we really haven't. And there could well be far more art, even older art. Maxine Aubert said there are at least 242 known cave art sites in this area of Indonesia, and probably hundreds more awaiting discovery in this one part of the island alone. The rest of this enormous island, the world's 11th largest, has barely been explored at all for cave art. So who knows what else is out there? And just interestingly, the way they discovered this cave was a guy climbed a tree and just happened to see an opening into a cave area. It's amazing. I know it's weird, it's not political, but I think it's really amazing to consider that those people at that time, they had no idea what would develop. I don't know, just a weird little thing. Meanwhile, in Spain, Greta Thunberg, Time's Person of the Year, she is not taking any time off to celebrate. She is putting pressure on governments, not just to move in the right direction on climate change, but to stop trying to deceive us about the efforts that they're currently undertaking. Here's a bit of what she had to say.
The politics needed does not exist today, despite what you might hear from world leaders. And I still believe that the biggest danger is not inaction. The real danger is when politicians and CEOs are making it look like real action is happening when, in fact, almost nothing is being done apart from clever accounting and creative PR. There is no sense of urgency whatsoever. Our leaders are not behaving as if we were in an emergency. In an emergency, you change your behavior. If there's a child standing in the middle of the road and cars are coming at full speed, you don't look away because it's too uncomfortable. You immediately run out and rescue that child. And without that sense of urgency, how can we, the people, understand that we are facing a real crisis? And if the people are not fully aware of what is going on, then they will not put pressure on the people in power to act.
So this is really important. What we need to do is not just get governments to say, okay, fine, we accept the science of climate change and we're gonna do something about it, but to make sure, to pressure them, not until they say they're gonna do something, but until every coal plant is shut down, we stop drilling for oil, until we've converted our transportation, our agriculture, all of that. Only at the end can we afford to rest, because the opposition that we're facing from the establishment is not just to like, talking about it, but it's to actually doing something. And they will try to co-opt this effort in every way that they can. She's identifying it in all these European countries, but we can see it even inside of the Democratic primary. They all say they want to do something about climate change. Do you really believe that they all believe it to the same extent, that they would make the same moves with the same urgency? No, don't become pacified by people that imply they're on your side. If they've been against it this long, don't expect that they're gonna wholeheartedly turn over to our support at this point. So congrats to Greta on continuing to put pressure on them in that way. Okay, we have a little bit more for you. It's gonna be overtime, so become a member. You'll be able to watch that live. It involves Pete Buttigieg and his lack of youth support. We've got that for you in just a little bit. It's not often that Pete Buttigieg faces hard questions when he goes on mainstream media shows, but we've got a bit for you here, and it involves his difficulty in generating enthusiasm amongst young voters. Take a look at how he responded to these questions.
You have talked about a new generation of leadership, and if you became president, you would be the youngest president in history. And yet you don't have a majority of young voters in this country, according to polls. Is there a way in which you're out of touch with your own generation?
No, but it is certainly the case that often younger candidates tend to attract more support from older voters. But we are building a coalition that's going to draw voters from every part of this country. Now, certainly,
you're at 3% and 4% among people under the age of 44 in South Carolina. It's almost as bad as minority voters. What explains that gap?
Look, there's going to be a continued process to earn support across the coalition. But it's certainly the case that many of the younger voters are more attracted to, for example, the Sanders campaign definitely has more young voters. I was a big fan of Bernie Sanders when I was 18 years old. It's also the case that we are pulling together a coalition to talk about issues like climate, to act on issues like climate and guns and the economy, that the longer you're planning to be here, the more you have at stake. And young voters have to mobilize in a way that hasn't happened before if we're going to be able to defeat this president.
Did you notice what he said there? What was that? What was that? This little mean girl storyline. Like, I liked Bernie too when I was 18. I've since learned so much. Okay, we can learn a lot by how you've changed since you're 18 when you wrote that glowing portrayal of Bernie Sanders. But he's is there any interpretation of that that is not young voters are dumb and so they support stupid people? When they get older, they'll support me because they'll become wiser. That's 100% what he's saying there. And I get that he's frustrated that so far young voters are not flocking to him. But I would say that you can't just expect that because you happen to be young, and he is young, I believe he's younger than me actually, that they're just gonna support you based on your identity as a younger person. No, they are smart and savvy. I would say far more so than older generations. They don't get just I guess bamboozled by rhetoric or the fact that he speaks a lot of languages or that there's good coverage of him in the media. They seem to like him. No, they actually care about the content of your proposals. Like, it's not like Bernie Sanders has some sort of natural appeal outside of ideology and values and policy. And we can't help but love Bernie. No, it's because he's right on the issues. He's right and he's specifically right. He speaks about it in a compassionate way about these policies, in an impassioned way. We believe him, there's authenticity there. That's something that can't be bought. We can see that almost immediately when we see a politician talking. And so I can do the same thing. When I'm watching Pete Buttigieg there and I see him just casually brushing off those admittedly hard questions. That's the most harsh I've seen with CBS, one of these mainstream shows be to Pete Buttigieg. Look at the little smile on his face. I know that I'm biased. I've endorsed Bernie Sanders. I'm not a fan of Buttigieg. But am I wrong in saying that that is smugness through and through? Like, oh yeah, the young voters don't love me, whatever. I'm building a coalition, something, something. Well, look, he is building something. That's true. The last couple of days, he's been in New York. He's been talking to Wall Street bankers and executives, and he's been raising a ton of money. That's what he's been doing. He's not specific about what sort of coalition, by the way. Perhaps that's the one he means. But are you surprised that young voters don't find that appealing? That at the same time that Bernie Sanders is with unions and he's walking the lines with them, he's fighting for workers' rights, Pete Buttigieg is trying to get more millionaires to support his candidacy? Maybe that's something to look into. And thankfully, the media is actually starting to do that. And this is not totally unexpected. The media, they love constancy. They love the idea that we could go back to a comfortable status quo, but they also love drama. And so, yes, they're gonna raise up Pete Buttigieg, but that gets boring after a while. At some point, they will be forced by their drive for ratings to ask some hard questions. That process looks like it's begun. And I would say that so far, Pete Buttigieg has shown a real lack of ability to deal with that without coming out looking like a smug, entitled politician. Okay, so that unfortunately is all that we have time for today. Thank you for sticking around, not only for the full show, but also for the overtime. We really do appreciate that. Tomorrow, Brett Ehrlich is gonna be joining me, but we also have an important special guest. This guy, he's running for Congress It's Cenk Weiger. Okay, he's Cenk Weiger. Okay, so he's going to be in studio, not as my co-host, but as a guest. I'm going to be talking to him about his candidacy. We might have some exciting special news that I can't actually divulge today. So you're not going to want to miss that. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.